our guests for some really useful insights with your questions. It gives me great pleasure now to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Sarah Hunter, Chief Economist and Assistant Governor Economic at the Reserve Bank of Australia. So those of you who had questions about interest rates, this is your time has come. Sarah was appointed Chief Economist and Assistant Governor Economic, one of the five assistant governors at the Reserve Bank of Australia in January 2024. She leads the bank's economic group, which comprises economic analysis and economic research in her role. Dr. Hunter is originally from the United Kingdom. Her interest in the field of economics began early when she was 16 years old. She's now 20. At her father's advice, she took economics as one of her three A-level subjects for her final school year. And the rest, as they say, is history, or more accurately, economics. Sarah went on to complete her Bachelor of Arts in Economics at Cambridge University, a Master of Science in Economics with distinction at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and a Doctor of Philosophy in Economics at Oxford University. She clearly earned her stripes, completing the triumvirate of education at the top global universities. You might think you cannot top that, but then here comes more. Sarah's economic career has spanned academia, public service, and private sector, starting as a lecturer at University of Oxford. She then went on to Oxford Economics, one of the world's foremost economic advisory consultancies. She completed that to go establish the American Office for Oxford Economics and then headed the America's Macro Consulting. As the true pathbreaker that she is, Sarah then moved to Sydney to establish the Asia-Pacific Macro Consulting for Oxford Economics, before taking up the role of Chief Economist of the BIS Oxford Economics. She was subsequently sought to fill the position of KPMG Senior Economist and Partner. Now, to top that, Sarah moved to the Australian Treasury as Head of Macroeconomic Conditions Division in February 2023. And in January this year, Sarah joined the RBA to direct the central bank's economic forecasts and lead the bank's economic group in economic analysis and economic research to provide key advice and recommendations to the RBA board. Sarah's expertise is as a macroeconomist and includes macroeconomic model building, simulations, econometric estimation, and forecasting, with an Asian, Australian, and global economy's geographical focus. Accordingly, Sarah will speak today on shedding light on uncertainty, using scenarios in forecasting and policy. Now, this is particularly timely in light of the recent South Korean political stalemate, the open sparring between the Filipino president and vice president, the no-confidence vote on the French prime minister and government, and so on. Please join me to invite Dr. Sarah Hunter to the podium today for her presentation.
Thank you very much for that, Fiona. That was an incredibly generous introduction, and it's an absolute pleasure to be here. Adelaide, I'd forgotten how beautiful Adelaide was. I hadn't been since before COVID. It's a stunning city, and it's lovely to see the city really coming to life in the intervening years. And I'd like to start by also paying my respects to the traditional and original owners of this land, to pay respect to those who have passed before us, and to acknowledge today's custodians. I also extend that respect to any First Nations people joining us here today. So as Fiona said, the topic for my speech today is all about uncertainty. And for me, economics is not black and white. Our data and our information is messy, to say the least, and I'm going to come back to that. and it's subject to interpretation. So our science, we call it a science, but it's inherently grey, the information that we deal with. I actually like to call it gloriously grey, as for me, trying to understand what's going on sets me on fire intellectually. It really does get me out of bed every single day. One way to think about different interpretations of the world is to think in terms of alternative scenarios, and that's what I'm going to talk about. How we at the RBA use scenarios, that is, alternative possible pathways for the economy, to help us think about the outlook, and then ultimately for the RBA board to help them set monetary policy. So our baseline forecast of how the economy may evolve is a key input to the monetary policy decision. It represents what we think is the most likely single path for the economy. But it's only one path, and the chance of that precise path being the one that happens is approximately zero. So acknowledging uncertainty inherent in our forecasts is really core to making good policy decisions. The systematic use of scenario analysis is common in many professions where decisions are made under uncertainty. So economists, we're not alone in not knowing exactly how things will play out. I often think of weather forecasters at this point. So, for example, scenario analysis is a fundamental part of financial stress testing exercises that are conducted on a regular basis by prudential regulators around the world. It's a good way of checking that the banks have got the capital they need if things go wrong. Many central banks use scenarios internally to inform their policy decisions, and some actually publish them. And the value of scenarios has been re-emphasized by the recent Bernanke review at the Bank of England and our own RBA review, which recommended greater use of scenarios to inform policy. So, why are they useful? Well, as forecasters, I think they can help us think through and communicate risks around our baseline. For example, by identifying the risks the forecast might be particularly sensitive to and the balance of risks around the central case. They can also help us keep an open mind about alternative explanations for how the economy is evolving. For policymakers, such as the RBA board, scenarios can provide a tangible link between risks and policy strategy. They allow policymakers to explore how a given policy option, choice, performs depending on how risks play out, or to compare alternatives. They also have the potential to help policymakers communicate how monetary policy may respond as conditions evolve. In economist parlance, we call this better communicating our reaction functions, how we react as things change over time. I'll develop these points in the rest of my remarks, and along the way, talk through some examples of recent scenarios we've used. But before I get into scenarios, I want to briefly set the scene by outlining the baseline forecast process and why the forecasts almost always turn out to be wrong in some way. I've learned to be humble about my abilities to predict the future. So the baseline forecast represents our central view of how the economy will unfold, conditional on a series of assumptions, including the exchange rate and the market implied path for the cash rate. The forecasts also embed a set of judgments about how the economy may evolve. And we typically call out the judgments that we think are most important in our key publications, such as the Statement of Monetary Policy. Recently, the key judgments have included assessments of the supply capacity of the economy. We've done an awful lot of work on productivity, the trajectory of the labour market, and the extent to which households will increase their spending as their real incomes recover, all things that Jim was referring to earlier on. The judgments and forecasts are built on a wide range of analysis of the data, models that embody relationships and linkages across the economy, and our assessment of how these relationships may evolve differently to what we've seen in the past. As well as resulting in quantitative forecasts, this process helps to refine our narrative for the economy, so the story of what's happening. Constructing a narrative in parallel with this detailed analysis and forecast outcomes can help test the forecasts, and it helps us to communicate our view of the economy. Something else I've learned as an economist, we have to learn to communicate with the rest of the world. But we know the future is uncertain, and forecasts will usually be wrong in various ways. Given this uncertainty, then, why do we spend so much time and effort on the forecasts themselves? Well, the answer, of course, is that monetary policy operates with a lag, which means the board needs to think ahead when setting the cash rate target today. As an aside, a very famous economist about 20 years ago described setting monetary policy as looking at driving a car whilst only ever looking in the rearview mirror. Forecasts are our attempt to look through the windscreen, but it's a little bit blurry, to say the least, and that's the uncertainty we face in our forecasts. Given the importance of looking ahead in the monetary policy decision, and the fact that we know forecasts often do not come to pass, there is significant value in thinking through the ways in which the forecast might actually be wrong. And as we'll see, scenarios help us do that. But first, why do forecasts turn out to be wrong? A bit of a defense for my profession, it's not just because we're bad at our jobs. We do our best. But there are things that can go wrong that are a little bit beyond our control. There are some things, though, about the future that we can be relatively confident about. For example, we know people typically spend more money in the last 3 months of the year in the lead up to the holiday season. Santa's getting expensive these days, at least in my household. Observations like this are so normal that we actually always look through them, so we don't really pay too much attention to that lift in household spending in the last 3 months of the year, because it happens every time. That said, even the seasonal pattern of household spending is shifting at the moment, with the ongoing growth here in Australia of Black Friday sales in November displacing some spending from December. Or put another way, we're pulling it forward, so we're buying our Christmas presents in November rather than December, which makes it tricky to read the data. And that's just the tip of the uncertainty iceberg. There are many reasons forecasts can turn out to be wrong. Most obviously, unpredictable events that will have a meaningful impact on the macro economy can happen. Think of the pandemic. I'll forgive myself for not forecasting that in late 2019. An unexpected change in domestic or foreign government policy, and one-off weather events that affect prices or economic activity. Jim was talking about the growing season here in South Australia being a bit weaker this year. You can think of tropical storms and banana crops and other shocks like that, and pretty hard to forecast. Relationships between variables can turn out differently. For example, households might save more or less of their income than they usually do. Or our models and analytical frameworks designed to capture these relationships could be incorrect or inaccurate or incomplete. We're always learning. Assessments of the current state of the economy could be wrong. And this could be due to imprecise data, and our data is often subject to sizable revisions, or assessments of things like spare capacity, which we can only infer from the data. We could be getting that wrong. It's entirely possible. And finally, undetected or uncertain structural changes in the economy can also cause unforeseen outcomes. We talked earlier about productivity. A change in the pace of underlying productivity growth may be caused by the green energy transition, the adoption of AI, expansion of digital technologies, or any other type of technological change. These could have wide-ranging impacts on the variables we forecast, but we don't know them today. We're only going to learn about them when we get to tomorrow. So, all of the above are specific cases of where we might be wrong in our baseline outlook for the economy. One way of quantifying and communicating general uncertainty in the forecast is the fan chart that the RBA shows in the Statement of Monetary Policy, and I've just put up the latest one for the trimmed mean inflation forecast. So these charts show the historical range of forecast errors around the current central forecast case, that's the black line, let's say in this case for trimmed mean inflation. The dark blue range shows that 70% of the time, our two-year ahead inflation forecast has been within plus or minus 1 percentage point of our central case. And 90% of the time, we've been within 2 percentage points either side of our central case. So the picture clearly highlights that we can't be very confident that our projections will come to pass, because as you can see, we've had some pretty wide error bands over the historical data. So now, while the fan charts illustrate the typical level of uncertainty, or the average level of uncertainty, if you like, around our forecast, scenarios enable a richer discussion of specific ways in which we might be wrong in our baseline view. So this could be due to any of the sources of uncertainty I previously listed, unpredictable events, economic relationships turning out to be different to what we thought, and so on. And so constructing a scenario involves making alternative assumptions to the ones that's encapsulated in our baseline about how things might play out, and then thinking through what that implies for the economic outlook. Now, we can do this qualitatively. Indeed, the usually rigorous discussions amongst economists about the outlook are effectively debates around different alternative scenarios. And I have many of those rigorous discussions both inside the RBA and with economists that work outside of the building. But at the RBA, we often will supplement those qualitative discussions with using our economic models to explore how these alternatives might affect the economy. Part of the value of producing scenarios is that they help us build our own understanding of the risks, which ones are important and which ones aren't, because the scenario makes clear how sensitive the outlook is to a given risk. Fiona was mentioning some of the political events that we've seen recently. Suffice it to say, some of those political events are likely to be more important than others. And so by using scenarios to gauge the impact of them, we can establish which ones might matter for us here in Australia and which ones don't. Scenarios also provide a way for us to communicate the risks that we think are most important and a tangible way of illustrating and quantifying them. By tracing through the impact of a risk onto both inflation and the labour market, the two parts of our mandate, they help us to understand how risk around these variables are connected in a way that the fan charts can't. So the fan chart just tells you, you know, sort of average forecast misses. It doesn't really tell you why you missed. That's where scenario analysis comes in. And for us as forecasters, there is a further possible philosophical benefit to producing scenarios. I wonder if it might reduce the chance that we become too attached to our central forecast narrative. Constructing scenarios means thinking through alternatives by their very nature. You have to challenge what you think might be happening. And I hope that that helps us to keep an open mind when our central forecast turns out to be wrong. Why is it wrong? What can we learn from that? And how do we adapt and change over time? And given, as what I've already said, that the forecast is very likely to be at least in some way wrong, I think that's quite a good, healthy mental discipline for the profession. More concretely, scenarios can help us identify the indicators and outcomes that will tell us when we are deviating from the baseline view. This helps us to identify when things are playing out differently, allowing us to update our baseline forecast accordingly. Now, I'll return later on to talk about the value of scenarios in informing the policy decision that the board takes. But first, let me give you two recent examples of scenarios that we've been exploring, because we think these risks matter for the outlook. Now, a key uncertainty that we've been focusing on recently is how household income growth will affect consumption, household spending, in the coming years. So what we can see happening in the data right now is that household real income growth is currently being lifted by the statutory tax cuts that are taking effect, by the return of wages growth to positive territory, as Jim outlined earlier on. But what we can't be certain about is how consumers will react to this lift in income. Running different scenarios allows us to see how the different responses might play out and how material this would be for the labour market and inflation. The alternative plausible path for consumption and the savings rate led to noticeably different paths for inflation and unemployment, which we're using as a catch-all indicator for labour market outcomes in general. And that means it would have consequences for policy settings. So now, we first published these scenarios in our August SNP. So around about 5 months ago now. And the staff and myself were all closely monitoring actual outturns and assessing their implications. And so to relate this to the chart, we're evolving our assessment of whether or not we're on the orange, blue, or green lines. And the answer to this question is pretty critical to the board. As a move to the scenarios depicted in green or orange, that's a departure from our baseline case, may require a change in policy strategy. As I said, I'll come back to that in just a minute. Now, to consider another scenario, as a small open economy, what's happening overseas will always matter for our domestic outlook, and external risks to the Australian economy can also be interrogated with scenarios. At any given time, there are many known external risks as well as unknown unknowns. Now, my colleague Deputy Governor Hauser discussed one of the key known unknowns at his speech on Wednesday, the global trading environment. And another current example of a material external risk is the path of future Chinese fiscal policy. China is a large economy, and as Jim showed, it's not just South Australia's largest trading partner, it's Australia's largest export destination. And that means the trajectory for its economy is a key consideration in Australian monetary policy settings. We can't ignore China, in a nutshell. Given the current evolution in policy settings in China, for those that pay attention, they actually announced some changes to settings just this morning. One way we have explored that is to consider the effects of Chinese fiscal spending being higher than expected, looser than expected. Now, there are several ways this could affect the Australian economy. Stronger demand in China increases prices for commodities that we export, as well as the price of Chinese exports that come to Australia. So you give a boost to demand and you'll get a little bit of an inflation response. Higher commodity prices increase Australian corporate profits and government tax receipts, and some of this could filter through into increased domestic spending. Stronger Chinese demand also increases demand for other Australian exports. In particular, services exports are more responsive to this kind of demand stimulus. So if we did see a stronger outlook for the Chinese economy, we'd likely see a pickup in tourism and inbound travel to Australia. Though this could be offset to some extent by what happens to the exchange rate, which I'll get to in just a second. And similarly, stronger demand in China lifts activity in other trading partners, many of which are important destinations for our exports. So there's an indirect effect as well. And having listed all of these things, you're perhaps seeing why we use models to help us run all of this. Very hard to do it in your head. I'd actually say impossible. And finally, financial channels might also impact the Australian economy. So while our direct financial linkages with China are relatively small compared to the trade linkages, which are very large, Chinese activity does influence exchange rates and asset prices. So if we did see a large stimulus package, we'd probably see an appreciation of the Aussie dollar, so the markets would move, and we'd probably see a bit of a boost to our equity market as well, so we get a bit of a wealth effect. So there's an awful lot going on. So the scenario that we've considered, it's on the screen at the moment, is a very large stimulus package. You can see the light blue line for China's growth is a long way above the dark blue, which is a sort of, roughly speaking, what our base case is right now. It's not an outcome that we think is likely to be announced in the near term. But looking at a large, if unlikely, stimulus gives us a sense of what it might mean for the Australian economy. And it also illuminates the channels that would be at play for a smaller stimulus. And to some extent, if we saw something a bit smaller, it would be the size that would differ, but the channels would look broadly the same. And so running something this size, we can really see them quite clearly. So while here we're looking at the impact of a stimulus package in isolation, in practice, it's very likely that if they did go this route, it would be because the growth prospects in China had deteriorated for some reason. So in that case, in fact, in reality, the impact on the Australian economy would differ to what you can see here on the screen. This is the glorious grey I was referring to earlier on. Unfortunately, it's never quite as simple as push a couple of buttons and see what happens. Things are always changing all the time. Now, the goal of all of this work for us at the RBA is to ultimately help inform good monetary policy making. That's what we're here to do. So I've already explained, I hope, how scenarios help us understand and communicate the importance of different risks to the outlook and the economy's sensitivity to different channels. So for example, in this scenario, the China fiscal case, we're showing how Australian outcomes might be affected by Chinese policy and how the transmission of the stimulus might be sensitive to movements in the exchange rate in particular. That's an important lever for us here. But now I'm going to focus on how scenarios can inform the policy decision itself. That's the decision the RBA board take. So clearly, central forecasts are important inputs to monetary policy decisions. As I said earlier on, monetary policy acts with a lag, so you've got to look ahead. But the extent of uncertainty means it's equally important for policymakers to consider alternative scenarios, their likelihood, and how their policy strategies might need to adapt as things play out. The key point is that scenarios help to make the link between forecast risks and policy strategy. That helps the board think through the options and communicate their thinking. In other words, it helps them to make decisions under uncertainty. In particular, scenarios allow policymakers to consider how to make their strategy more robust to key risks materializing. Now, that might mean choosing a policy strategy that performs well in terms of inflation and labor market outcomes, that arduous mandate, under a range of possible scenarios rather than in just the most likely central case. Scenarios can also help the board communicate how policy settings might need to respond if the economic outlook unfolds differently to our baseline. As flagged earlier, in economist speak, they can help the board to communicate its reaction function to financial market participants and the general public, helping them understand what might happen to interest rates over time. Or put another way, if you had a reasonable understanding of what might be happening to interest rates, hopefully you could make a good decision about whether or not to buy a house or borrow some money to start a business, whatever it is that you might be doing in your day-to-day lives. So, for example, the November board minutes show examples of the board considering alternative risks to the outlook for household spending and the labour market and mapping these through to the potential consequences for policy. Now, to make this more concrete, the charts you're now looking at provide an illustration of the sort of scenarios we might look at to map from risks to possible policy responses. Now, I want to emphasise that these are not actual scenarios the RBA board has considered. While some central banks do publish alternative policy paths that inform their decisions, the RBA board has not yet done so. So what you're actually looking at are hypothetical policy responses to illustrative scenarios where demand and so inflation are stronger or weaker than a base profile. Or put another way, I'm trying to show you graphically what the conversation at the board might look like. So now, the board has consistently communicated that it's aiming to return inflation to the midpoint of the target band, that's 2.5%, in a timely manner, while retaining as many of the gains in the labour market as possible. The two cases considered here don't actually achieve those outcomes. That is, they would not bring the economy back into balance in the second half of 2026. In the strong demand scenario, inflation would stay above 2.5% through the forecast horizon, while in the weak demand scenario, it would drop below 2.5% by the end of the forecast horizons. And that's the black lines in the right-hand panels of the two charts. Sorry, the left-hand panels, the two charts that you're looking at. Now, while the policy paths shown in these charts are not necessarily the ones the board would follow, they do illustrate how the strategy may need to be adapted as conditions unfold, so if one or other of these cases came to pass. In the upside scenario, the board may need to consider a tighter policy stance. This could be a rate hike, or it might be a longer period on hold. In the downside the scenario, the board may need to consider a looser stance, for example, by bringing forward rate cuts. And a final comment on these charts, the base policy profile, that was based on market pricing for the cash rate. So that's not the board's forecast. The board don't do forecasts of the policy rate over time. That's based on what their financial markets think. So where does all of this leave us? Well, each quarter, the staff, that's my team and I, we prepare a forecast for the economy based on our careful assessment of the data, past historical relationships, but acknowledging that we also have to impose judgments and assumptions on the outlook. You can't do forecasting without those. When we look at our forecasts and when we work through our models and our analysis, we identify key judgments and risks, and we use those to create scenarios that will differ from our central forecast. These scenarios help us to understand the risks, they feed into the policy advice, and we now include them in the Statement of Monetary Policy. It's quite a long document, I promise if you get towards the end of it, you'll find them. Though they only ever cover a fraction of the overall uncertainty around the outlook, so we're not trying to cover the whole of the fans. The board evaluates this information when setting policy, focusing on the strategy's robustness amid inherent risks and the delayed effects of monetary policy on the economy. We hope the scenarios we publish help financial markets and you know, and others in the public better understand the forecasts and the policy decisions. And I also hope, personally, that they encourage broader debate and discussion about what's going on across the economy, back to that glorious grey. Thank you, and I'm looking forward to taking your questions.
Thank you so much, Sarah. That was really illuminating. I'm here to help moderate, and we have mics roving. If you could provide your name and your affiliation when you raise the question, that would be really helpful.
Thank you, Sarah. Brent and Catherine from Premier and Cabinet. This might be a slightly odd question given you've just spent the last 20 minutes talking about looking forward, but I'm just wanted to talk a little bit about looking backward mm-hmm. and the role of scenarios in retrospective mm-hmm. reviews. You know, how often or how does the bank go back and look at the choices you made at the time, how it played out, and what you might have done differently?
Excellent question. So the answer is that we do, and we do it through a few different lenses. So maybe starting with a very big retrospective, the RBA review did a lot of that. So it was a wide-ranging review of the whole institution, but the monetary policy part of it was partly an exercise in doing that, going back and assessing different points in time. It particularly focused on the pre-COVID years, so around 2016-ish through to 2019, and then also the policy response during COVID, and really drew out a number of lessons from that. So big reviews like that are one way. Other ways that we do it, though, every year we do a forecast review. We publish it on our website. It was published in November. So that's a way for us within the economic group to really assess how we've seen things playing out over the economy. What have we learnt? What did sort of happen the way we sort of broadly thought it would, what didn't. So that's part of it. And the board themselves have dedicated time where they reflect. I think that's actually really critical. These policy decisions are hard. They're made, as I said, with uncertain, incomplete information. So think of driving a car looking in the rearview mirror. Sometimes you're not going to get it quite right for reasons that might be beyond your control, but maybe you should have read something a bit different. So we're actually very conscious of needing to do that retrospective exercise. It's really, really critical, taking it forward, learning from it, improving the models, improving the analysis, and hopefully getting better time after time after time. But it's a constant process. I don't think you can ever think that you're done. And I think as soon as you do think you're done, maybe time to have a go at something else. That's a good question. I think it's learning, it's different things at different points in time. I think from the pre-COVID years, the lesson there was, particularly for Economic Group, around being open to different sort of interpretations of what's happening and different understandings of the economy. So we're very alive to that. We have very robust debates internally, I can promise you. And we're also now active in seeking out opinions and inputs from outside the building. So, for example, we've established regular roundtable discussions with market economists and with academics. So they come into the building, we have the discussion, so we get to learn from that. They can perhaps learn a bit about our thinking too. We weren't doing that until relatively recently. So that's one thing we certainly learned from that period. And I think from the COVID years, it probably won't be a surprise to say that the board certainly took on a lot of learnings about the communication of policy and how we get our message across. I'm very conscious that as an economist, there's a lot of language and words that we use that are just not the lexicon of everyone else. And we have to adapt to that because we need to communicate with everyone and everyone needs to understand it. That's been a particular focus of the governor this year. I know she's always keen to hear feedback on how people are receiving her press conferences and her other engagements, but that's something we're really focused on too. So different things at different times.
Thanks, Sarah. Genevieve Knight from SACE. Just wondering, you did speak about how you've reviewed your COVID responses, etc. At the last briefing, the Vice-Chancellor mentioned that they expect another pandemic. Mm. Mm-hmm. So how have you been preparing forecasts for that?
So I can't say that we're prepared. So I would say that seems like a reasonable expectation. If you look back through human history, pandemics are not unique events. They happen I won't say regular frequency, but they certainly happen again and again and again. So it seems reasonable to think that in the forward-looking view of humankind, we'll have at least one more to deal with. In terms of thinking about forecasts and the policy response, so we haven't prepared a set of forecasts, mostly because that really depend on what type of pandemic we were talking about, what the response would be in other countries, and there's so much uncertainty about how it would actually play out that in terms of my team's time and where I think we can get most bang for buck on the work that we do, I don't know that thinking and producing detailed forecasts for things like pandemics is necessarily the best use of time. But what we have done is, in terms of the policy response, we've done a whole series of reviews of all of the various different unconventional policies that we use through COVID. So you can find them on our website. We published the last of those, which was the term funding facility. That was the funding we gave to the local banks at very, very low rates so that they could then pass it on to their borrowers, so households and businesses. We just did that last one. So we have reviewed all of our unconventional policies, what worked, what didn't. Those reviews will go through in some detail, the lessons we take forward into the future, how we would do them differently if we had our time again, going back to the start of COVID. And so for the board, that's been a really, I'd say, a good, reflective, healthy exercise so that they can learn. So when they have to make that decision again, which, as you point out, I would think probably a board in the future will have to do that again, they'll be armed with more information. Equally, though, they'll probably make some missteps the next time around, because it's never completely clear, and hindsight is a wonderful thing, but as long as you're learning, I think that's the main thing to take forward.
Thanks, and I had one small additional. We had a person mention the issue about regional forecasts. We don't do them at SAIS, and I guess the RBA really has a national focus. How much do you account for regional or state variation in your forecasting?
No, really good question. So so we are innately national in what we're trying to do. We operate at the aggregate level. So we certainly don't do very detailed state-level forecasts, and other institutions do that have that more local focus, such as SAIS for South Australia. Though, having said that, we do care very much about how different parts of the country are sort of evolving and playing out over time. And we gather that information in a few ways. We do look at state-level data. We have our fantastic liaison program. I'm joined by some colleagues from our Adelaide office here today who will go and talk to organisations all around the country. So from South Australia, we cover Adelaide, of course, but the guys also get out to the Barossa. They get up to Darwin every so often. So we have people in Perth, in Brisbane, and in Melbourne as well, as Sydney, where headquarters are. So we're trying to cover the whole country. We interview around about 900 organisations a year. We've been doing it for over 20 years. So as Jonathan said at the start, we've now got 20,000 interview notes that we can pass to really get some insights from. So that's an incredibly powerful information set that we have access to that we factor into our forecasts. And more just generally, in a very aggregate sense, what's really interesting as an economist, but so important and vital for how this economy aggregately responds, is how the states will often be performing in different ways. So right now, Western Australia is very strong. South Australia here, you guys have had a really good patch. It's really, as I said at the start, wonderful to see. Other parts of the country, in relative terms, are performing a bit more slowly, and in a relative sense, are sort of falling behind a bit. Victoria is a good example of that. That's not always the case. Pre-COVID, it was actually almost the opposite, so perhaps a little bit softer in terms of growth momentum here. Victoria was actually the leader. And so seeing how those ebbs and flows come together and come through in the aggregate data is really important for our understanding of the economy. So I don't have a set of state forecasts at my fingertips, but I do have quite a lot of information about what's happening, and I'd say it's vital for the outlook.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for being here for today. My name is Davin Lambert. I'm from the LGFA, Local Government Finance Authority here in South Australia. I'm just wondering, with your baseline forecast, how much do you look at the potential fiscal spending from the elections coming forth? Do you get into the political side and have debates about where you think the different political parties will spend and so forth as well?
So we're obviously aware of when state and federal elections might be. And so that's sort of known. But in terms of our forecasts, they're based on announced policies and legislative policies. So as we are right now, we've factored into our forecasts the federal budget that was handed down in May, the state budgets that came through about the same time through to, I think, the Tassie budget was the last one, and it was in September, October, I believe. Those settings as they are today are what we include in the forecast, and we run those through. As new announcements, new policies get legislated, then, of course, we'll update the forecast. And that, indeed, is one of the sources of uncertainties for us. Governments, by their very nature, and of course this is what they're there to do, will change their policies over time. We don't try and forecast those. We take them in as assumptions once we know about them.
Hi, Sarah. Yeah, I'm Furman from the School of Economics and Public Policy. So you haven't shared the forecast modeling. So I'm wondering whether you are considering the frequentist forecasting or the Bayesian forecasting in your scenarios. So the reason I'm saying that is that because you are saying we are in an uncertainty world, and obviously, how can you quantify the uncertainty if you are doing frequentist forecast?
It's an excellent question. We don't try to do that in an aggregate sense. So we have the fan charts that I showed you earlier on, and then when we consider alternative scenarios, they're very discrete. And we're not trying to attach probabilities to them. For basically the reason you just said, it would be incredibly complicated and hard because we'd have to have those Bayesian probabilities for each of the individual series that we're forecasting that sit within our models, and then we'd have to interact them all. It would get difficult and complicated very quickly. And I'm also not quite sure in a scenario world how we would attach distributions to outcomes and probabilities to outcomes as well, because we only have one run of history. So we don't. It's not as if we can roll the dice, as it were, 1,000 times and see what comes out. We can't. We only get one run. And so trying to figure out what those probabilistic distributions look like and the interdependencies look like across all the different series that we model in a general equilibrium sense gets pretty tricky and pretty hard. We don't have it. Other organizations have certainly tried to do that with more general forward-looking stochastic deviations. That's a possibility. What you end up with actually is something that looks akin to a fan chart. There's a lot more underneath it, and so you can make an argument that it's a bit more rigorous than the fan chart approach that we do. But I suppose in a practical sense, you end up in about the same place. So we've not tried it. It would be very hard. If you're trying it, I'd love to hear about that and see how you get on.
Ralph Bayer, also School of Economics, Public Policy. Goes a little bit in the same direction. So you have multiple uncertainties and ambiguities in there. So you have model uncertainty. Is the model right? You have uncertainty about assumptions you make. And you have ambiguity. Something could happen where you have no idea beforehand that it could ever happen. If you look backwards, have you tried to attribute fractions to forecasting error to those different uncertainties and ambiguities?
Yeah, really good question. So it's certainly the case in terms of model uncertainty, we do work to review our models and then to update them, to update the relationships over time. So to maybe give an example, we're looking very closely at the moment at the relationship between job vacancies and the unemployment rate, which for economists is the Beveridge curve. And so we're trying to work out what level of vacancies is consistent with the labour market being at full employment. So that's really important. So we want to try and gauge how much of the current vacancies is because there's really strong demand for labour and how much of it is because there's just natural churn in the labour market. It's always people moving around job to job, students graduating, getting a job, or looking for a job and then getting a job and so on. So we do it for that model uncertainty. In that way, we can identify that. Identifying all those, unpacking all of those other things you mentioned, though, and I would throw into that data uncertainty, because we're only ever working with the current vintage of data, and we do get revisions, sometimes quite substantial ones. That makes it really, really hard then to look and to think how much of it was because of something we didn't know about, how much of it was something that we couldn't see, and then how much of it was an actual error on our part. We try that on a very partial basis, so we might look at one or two indicators. We've not tried it for our entire general equilibrium model because that would be quite an undertaking. But you're right, the more we can do, the better. So it is part of our learning, but it's a tricky exercise.
No, we're good. We likely have time for another question.
Nathan Petrus from the Local Government Association. I'm interested in any insights you might be able to provide on how your board might use this information on scenarios to make decisions. And the thought that comes to my mind is, as kind of diverse people on the board, they will have different thoughts around each scenario. Do we want to act to minimise the downside? Do we want to act based on the most probable of those scenarios? Everyone probably brings a unique perspective on that and that collective decision making around that. You may not be able to comment on how the decision making process unfolds, but that's an interesting part to me of how this information is actually used to make decisions.
Yeah. So I certainly won't comment on individual board members. And I should disclose I sit with the board as they make the decision, so I have a lot of information, but I wouldn't do that. But I would say that in general, you're absolutely right. The idea behind having a group of people that make this decision rather than just one individual is that you do get those different perspectives, that you get the challenge to different views, that people come in with a different idea, or they put different weights on different scenarios, to take it back to where my talk went. And so the board do that. They talk through those alternatives. They do talk about the risks around the outlook and where they might see the balance of risk, but also where they would be more concerned or less concerned about a deviation from our baseline forecast. So would they be more concerned about inflation looking different to what we expect it to versus labour market outcomes looking different to what we expect them to be? And that all comes together then in the collective decision-making process. So it is very considered. I mean, the meeting now runs across a Monday and a Tuesday, so there's a lot of time that they spend doing this, and then obviously they get the papers ahead of that. They will have read those and produce their own 10 hours that go into it. Each meeting is not insubstantial. And then you get the decision from that, and it is very much a collective decision. So, I would say that is how they operate. What you described is what happens on the ground, as it were. What we're trying to do and what the RBA review called out for us to do as bank staff was just to provide more structure around, particularly around this uncertainty and alternative scenarios piece. So that's why we are now doing publishing in the SNP, but also providing to board members that specifically those alternatives. We refer to how the data has played out relative to what we thought and what we've learnt when it's the same and what we've learnt when it's been different to what we thought. And then we have good discussion and challenge around that. So it's more or less what you described. I personally think that's very healthy, and that's what it should be. And that's why you have a group of people rather than an individual. It is to get that diversity of perspective.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sarah Hunter. I now invite Professor Jody Conduit, Executive Dean of the Faculty of Arts, Business, Law, and Economics, to provide the formal thanks and presentation of GIPT.
Thank you, Fiona. On behalf of the University of Adelaide and also the South Australian Centre for Economic Studies, I firstly want to thank all of you for coming and joining us today. I'd particularly like to express our gratitude to our two distinguished speakers who've provided us with such valuable insights. I'd like to acknowledge first Jim Hancock from SACES, who's given us a comprehensive overview of the economic conditions at the state and national level. His analysis, of course, helps us to better understand the complex interplay of so many factors that are shaping our economic landscape. We've been very privileged to hear today from Dr. Sarah Hunter, the Assistant Governor and Chief Economist at the Reserve Bank of Australia. Her presentation on uncertainty in forecasting and the use of scenarios in policy development was particularly timely and enlightening. As we navigate through evolving economic conditions, understanding how to better manage them and account for this uncertainty becomes increasingly crucial for both policymakers and business leaders that are in the room today. So, to Sarah, before you return to Sydney, we would like to present just a small token of our appreciation with some goods from South Australia. So just in closing today, I just note that in the room we have parliamentarians, people from the public sector, business leaders, NGOs, who all have a shared commitment to understanding and shaping South Australia and Australia's economic future. So these briefings that we hold serve as vital forums for our knowledge sharing and for discussion of critical economic and policy challenges shaping our state. Today, I said, I thank you all for giving up your time, and I believe that you'll leave here far richer for the experience and for the words of wisdom from Dr. Sarah Hunter and from Jim Hancock. So as we approach the holiday season, I encourage you to plan a scenario, did you get what I did there, in which you have good times you're spending with family and friends. Thank you once again for your participation, and I wish you a safe and happy holiday period.